Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artist. And our guest this week, Anne Strike Kurz. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here, and I look forward to sharing a little bit about myself.
Yes. Been trying to line one up with you for quite a while. I'm really glad to get this one to go here. enjoy your work. It's nice. Different.
Yeah, I'm sorry we haven't met before, but I've been around for a long time. I've heard nothing but good things about you.
Uh-oh. Well, that's good to hear.
I won't reveal my sources.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah. Just keep it quiet. Yeah. You've done an awful lot. I'm gonna get this question in. It has nothing to do with a sequence of logical discussion or anything. Mm-hmm. And I admit I have not sat down and spent hours studying it. Can you explain to me what a diaper pattern is? What does that mean?
It's probably the question that I get asked the most just because of the amount of research I've done on it. It's actually a weaving term. And most of the young mothers who are interested associate it more with the baby's diapers. And that really is not a coincidence.
There is a tie in there.
Very definitely. Oh. It's a textile term, and it means lozenge, actually. And the baby's bird's eye diaper, which my generation used, but has been replaced by Pampers and Loves and other disposables, was actually a woven fabric that had a diamond repeat. And I have several of those that I save for dust rags, so I usually share them with my classes where I am teaching that subject. It is a natural one for needlepoint because both needlepoint and weaving are based on a warp and a weft. So often you have interchangeable patterns. And when I lived in Midland, Michigan, it was interesting because the foremost authority on weaving diapers lived in Bay City and was a member of our fiber guild. So it's very important to weavers as well. But I basically got into my research through the Master Craftsman Program for the Embroiderers Guild of America. And the fourth module of that six-step program was on diapers. And we all wondered why it was so important. But if you do a pattern, a composite pattern, particularly in two colors, it often has what we call an all-over repeat. And the technical definition that the master craftsmen use is it's any pattern which forms visual diagonals in both directions. So if a pattern repeats on the diagonal, in both directions, it also has a vertical repeat and a horizontal repeat. So the easy way to describe it is in an all-over pattern. And I like to add the fact that it has to be in one or more colors. I mean, two or more colors.
Okay, all right, so back up. So I'm looking at the cover of your book, Diaper Patterns, and, mm-hmm. and cute that you put a folded-up diaper in the middle. You know, bravo for you on that. But... So I see that. So diagonals in both ways, and then in those diagonals, you have a vertical and a horizontal.
Right. It's a necessity, really. And then it just becomes a matter of scale. You can have a small scale pattern with itty bitty stitches, or you can have a very large overall pattern if you have room for it. And I would say many of my borders, even though they're considered stripes because they're borders, they actually have that inherent repeat. But it's not in the Master Craftsman program. If you use a pattern, you have to have a minimum of 3 to 4 repeats. And, of course, a border would not have that because it's a band. But I love to create them, and it's not really deliberately something I do. It just happens but with the technique that I use, which is a lot of four-way units that are bold to begin with. And then I just fill them in and make them pretty. With other techniques. So it is an interesting topic, and most of what I do actually relates more to pattern than it does actually to needlework, because that was what I was most interested in when I got into needlework. And needlework just is the way that I express it after I play with it with a pencil, basically.
Yeah. Well, now that you explain that, that's I know it's been explained to me more than once. I'm not... I've asked this question before, but it's never stuck with me. But now looking at the cover of your book and with that explanation, now I can see why diaper patterns pop up all the time, because I immediately see the power of them in design. Because
there's another needlework teacher in your area who's a mathematician too, and Diane Herman and I have had some interesting discussions, because there are definitely variables that don't overlap. But now that she is stitching, and she too went into the Master Craftsman program, we both have helped each other, and I've enjoyed, you know, hearing her side of it as well.
Yeah, no, I did a show with her, and actually she came to our Fox chapter and did a couple of programs, and she's probably the last person who tried to explain it to me. And she's, you know, she's amazing. She's just an amazing designer anyway. But yes, okay, so I see how that works. So then with the diagonals going both ways and the verticals, then there really is a tremendous number of design options presented just with that.
Yeah. No, to me, when you talk about needlework patterns, I break them down into composite patterns, which can be either what I call groundings. It's any two stitches put together that are in one monochromatic, interpretation, or it can be a stripe if you have a thrust in one direction only. But if that thrust is both ways or vertical and horizontal together, it becomes a diaper. So there are not too many, but I have several patterns that actually can go all three ways.
Hmm. Okay. Now I'm educated. It was just the minute that we set things up, that was going to be my primary question. I had to get that straight in my head. Now, on to the fact that you grew up, that you were in Michigan. See, I was born in Flint and grew up in Clyle. So just,
okay, well, that's actually not my native area. I've just spent the last 30 years there. I was actually born on the West Coast.
That's pretty native,
well,
30 years.
Well, I remarried, so that was actually a turning point. And Bill took a job out there, so he just retired. So now we're in Maryland, but I enjoyed those years. We were in a wonderful town called Midland, which is Dow Chemical's headquarters. So I used to call it the Wilmington of the Midwest, because it was one of those model cities that they created to attract their employees. So we felt very lucky.
Yeah. Is that where he worked, is Dow Chemical?
No, he didn't. He actually was CEO of a company that was 20 miles north of there. But it was in a very rural area, but it had more to do with thermoforming and was automobile related, certainly, rather than chemical related as well. But in his later years, he was with a consulting firm that were all Dow retirees. So my mechanical engineer suddenly became a chemical engineer by exposure. But he loves to learn stuff. So that was the last decade that we spent out there.
Yeah, Dow retirees who went into consulting to make real money. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting, I'm always curious, because, Michigan's one of my favorite states, and the UP, the UP is, you know, without a doubt, I just love it up there. But
it is gorgeous.
Yeah. But when I was growing up, I mean, it's an interesting culture because of the automotive industry. And my dad was one of, I could probably count on one hand, parents when I was going to school who did not work for the auto industry in one way or another, because it's pretty hard to avoid. And especially in those days,
well,
back in the
60s. I found that other than the foreign people that came into the town, many of the friends that we made never left. I mean, they all grew up in Michigan. They went to either University of Michigan or Michigan State.
Right. Uh-huh.
And they used to think it was kind of crazy that I sent out Christmas cards, because their families were all in the area and they had never lived away from home. So, and of course, it is very much, in my opinion, a very male-oriented culture, with the hunters and the fishermen and all the interesting ski-doos and other active sports that you find indigenous to the area.
Oh, yeah, and that's very much, because when I moved to Illinois, the hunting, where I live, northwest of Chicago, the hunting and boating and all those things are not a priority for the vast majority of people. I mean, there's the people in the Chain of Lakes area that have a lot of boats, but hunting and those kinds of things, and people don't understand. But then, yeah, you get into states like Michigan and Wisconsin, and yeah, it's a completely different culture. All of that is very much at play, and every weekend it's get out of town to go snowmobiling or hunting or fishing or something. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the women as well. My husband loved to tell the story of having to come to McCormick for a convention one time. So he asked two of his customer engineers to come, and it was the first day of hunting. And one of them very, you know, said he couldn't wait because he wasn't the hunter. It was his mother-in-law and his wife who did the hunting, and he only went along to drag the deer to the car.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. And my sister, who is youngest, she's very much a hunter. She and her husband hunt all the time, and it's a different culture. While rifle season in the fall, I was one of maybe two or three boys who were in school when the season opened, because we were archery people, so we went hunting archery time, and everybody was gone. All the boys went hunting. Yep.
Yeah. Well, now we're in the land of the bird hunting.
Yes.
On the Eastern Shore. It's a totally different orientation.
That's right. Yeah, that gets, yeah,
I
that
did
changes.
As a,
yeah.
As a kid.
Yeah.
But we look forward to the flyovers, but other than that, we'll shoot with a camera.
Yep. Yep. So where does the needlework come in? Did you learn that as a child?
That was all actually a midlife crisis of sorts. I did grow up in Winchester, Virginia, and I had a working knowledge of Williamsburg, and I grew up in an 18th century colonial home that we actually restored. Jefferson County, West Virginia, has 7 Washington homes that were, the land was actually surveyed by Washington, and he intended to build on that. But when he became president, he decided Mount Vernon was a better location. But a lot of his nephews and relatives settled in Jefferson County, West Virginia. And during the 30s, my family moved to Charlestown, and we actually lived in one of those homes and restored it. So I naturally had a little bit of an historical background in it. And I ended up majoring in American studies, of all things. So when I ended up in New England later on, one of the things I was doing in Ridgefield, Connecticut was docent work through an 18th century tavern that was called the Keeler Tavern. And it was a very important landmark in the area because it was on the Boston Post Road. So we had a very interesting curator that I was very fond of, and I got involved is when I moved there in 1969. And we started a program where we had junior hostesses as well as senior hostesses as docents. And one of the things we decided to do was to introduce some of these docents to colonial arts and crafts if they had been unfamiliar, previously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I wasn't that interested in actually stitching, but I told my partner in crime I would help her, you know, do it, and I would come serve the lunches. And I think I did take the caning class because I had a chair that I wanted to cane, but I wasn't intending to take either the needlepoint or the crewel class. I had a mother-in-law in Hagerstown, Maryland, who actually did a lot of crewel and did a lot of Elsa Williams kit. She was totally self-taught, but whenever mm-hmm. I admired one of Mom's pieces, she wouldn't mind doing it again, so I would get my own the following Christmas, so I never felt obligated to actually stitch. But after we organized these classes the first time, we had a cancellation the morning of the needlepoint class, so my partner called me and asked me to take that person's place so we didn't have to face the curator with a loss on the class.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and the minute I saw the graph, I thought, oh, this is just like graph paper and what I used to do as a kid, you know, doing my own little mosaic designs with colored pencils. So I was intrigued, but I was also at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I actually had lived in Poughkeepsie, New York, from 63 to 68. And during that period of time, I heard about the Millbrook School of Needle Art, which is founded by a lady named Mrs. Parshall. And she just happened to be the same lady who brought the English Guild to New York City and founded the American chapter of the Embroiderers Guild. My neighbor there had been going up there for classes. And at the time, the first teacher was Erica Wilson. And I think Erica was there maybe 3 or 4 years before she met her husband, who was a antique dealer on Fifth Avenue. And after she left, of course, she established her shop on Fifth Avenue on one of his properties. And the second teacher was another British Royal School of Needlework graduate named Gillian McKenzie. And the third teacher, who was the one who was there when I lived in Poughkeepsie, was a Danish lady named Olga Hansen. And I was intrigued by the idea of going up there, but I had just started my family, so I did not think it was the right time to get involved. But my neighbor had been, and I saw quite a few of the things that she had been producing. And it was very much English style in the way that they approach their classes. You actually signed up for 10 lessons, but you dropped in very casually, and you could stay for an hour, you could stay all day, but everybody was working on something different. There was no formal curriculum as such. Oh, mm-hmm. And early on, you were encouraged to design and decide what you wanted to do. This became very popular in the area. So even if I had wanted to get involved, I probably would have had to be on the waiting list for a while, because some of the people actually would keep paying for their classes even though they spent the winter in Florida.
Oh.
But later, as more guilds formed, there was less demand for, you know, one single option like this. So I was able to go up from Connecticut and have a one-day class with Olga Hansen. And I chose to do it in black work just because that was not a subject that I thought the Danes really specialized in.
Right.
So it was interesting to see another point of view other than the one that I'd been exposed to.
Right.
So it was a very nice experience.
Yeah. Was there a dominant technique? Was it needlepoint with wool or crewel, or what was the one that
it
most
was
were
pretty
doing?
Broad, it was pretty broad based. I would say surface stitchery was probably the most popular at that time. But this is late 60s, remember.
Yeah.
And the Embroiderers Guild was pretty much counted thread and crewel, and only a little bit of needlepoint at that time. And the American Needlepoint Guild was a Southern-based group that started later. And I think their first chapter was actually in Boston. I'm not sure when that chapter was established, but Sue and Phil Strauss were in that chapter, and they were two of the founders, or she was one of the founders and early presidents of A&G. But A&G did not grow that quickly in the Northeast, whereas EGA did. So most of my early training was actually in counted thread techniques, and I ended up taking everything I could once I was exposed to it, just because I love to learn things.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually started, the main guild near me was in Hartford base, where a lot of the well-known teachers had founded the Connecticut River Valley chapter. And that group was 450 strong.
Wow.
And used to have a seminar at Miss Porter's School in Farmington, Connecticut. But they did not meet every month. They met quarterly. And then they had what they called wing workshops, which were, they would hire one teacher and she would teach the same class in three different locations, because it was pretty much all of New England that was encompassed there.
Yeah.
But gradually, as guilds grew, I mean, my group in Fairfield County, which I helped to start, started with 15 of us, and we grew from 15 to 300 in 2.5 years. So you can see what happened. I kind of called it the renaissance of embroidery, because not only did you have the opportunity to take so many classes with that size group, but you were also beginning to see commercial thread. Well, Lois Caron actually was one of my early teachers. And, of course, she started watercolors and impressions and wildflowers and her threads early on. And my home state of West Virginia is where Krynek, started in Parkersburg. And I met the Kryniks in New York City once when I substituted for one of their teachers at a trade show. And so we've always enjoyed our West Virginia roots together. And that's a very interesting story, to the way the Kryniek family founded their business, because Jerry was actually laid off from... it was not Kimberly Clark. It was another firm, but he was a chemist, and his wife was a couturier, tailor in the area, and they wanted to stay in Parkersburg. So Jerry asked Estelle how he could help her in her business. And she said, oh, I can never get any silk thread, you know, or I can't get the quantities I want or need. So he actually went over to France and helped Auvergne-sois get their act together so that they could actually, you know, export and become a presence, you know, here. So that was actually how they got started. And then they expanded on the metallics from there. Mm-hmm. So it's now a three generation, you know, business. But they were wonderful people to work with. And I enjoyed teaching for them.
Yeah, as hard as it is, it seems to me, as hard as it is to get silks today, maybe another visit is warranted. I don't know. But silks are tough to get, slow moving. Yeah.
No, I actually don't use a lot of silks in my work because I just find I can get my effects. I want threads that come in different weights. And that's one of the ways I get the effects that I do is so that I'm mixing. I'm not looking for coverage since a lot of my patterns are slightly open.
Right.
So by using threads like pearl cotton, I can get four different weights depending on the size of canvas that I'm using. Right. And some of the ribbons and velours, you know, come in two different weights too. So that's actually more useful to me. And I love the look of silk. I love working with it. And I have taken Japanese embroidery, but for my own work, I try not to get into it. And I don't use a lot of the hand-dyed threads either, because I find that they will interrupt my patterns.
Yeah.
I use them in a certain way as long as all the values are the same. But I don't use the ones that look so gorgeous on the skein, but then cause a lot of streaking when you actually stitch with them.
Yeah, yeah, they have their place, and then they have a place where they don't belong. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. So it interests me, the whole history of it interests me, because when mm-hmm. I learned, my first technique was needlepoint. And mm-hmm. that was in the mid 70s. And that was, of course, wool, primarily basket weave wool on, I'm sure, 13 count canvas. You know, the thought of doing something on 18 count was just frightening. But that's, you know, that's what I learned. And then along came the cross stitch craze, which, you know, that was, I guess, in the 80s. Where there were cross stitches shops everywhere, but so in New England then it was a real mix from what you're telling me.
I don't know of a single cross stitch shop that I remembered when I lived there. I certainly saw them when I traveled.
Yeah.
And some of my early students actually, my first teaching was actually with correspondence courses. And I can remember that some of the group leaders would always say, please be gentle in your evaluations of the new member that we have because she's only done cross stitch. And ironically, quite often that piece would have been the best one just because she was intimidated and she also read the directions completely. And I must say I was a little bit devious in that I put because I did not necessarily follow the same sequence that other books followed, there was always something that I could tell that the other stitchers did not follow. And I used to get accused of spending more time looking at the back than I did the front when I did evaluations, but that was only to confirm what I suspected on the front. So, of course, the cross-stitch person didn't really have any precedent for needlepoint, so she followed the directions to the T, and generally, if there was a problem, it was usually in the tension control because she wasn't used to the canvas being, as heavily sized as it was.
Right.
But all I really care about is that somebody reads a chart well, and a cross-stitch person will always be able to read a chart.
Right. Yeah. Because that's their training. Otherwise, they die. it comes all apart. Yeah. 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 That's that tension thing. I go back and forth, and I struggle with that. If I've done needlepoint for a length of time, to go to stitching, doing cross stitch on linen, I just want to yank it tight, and I cause myself so many problems because I'm used to pulling on canvas. And
yeah, well, that was my biggest problem when I learned any kind of stitching, because I'd always been very athletic. And I can remember the first pull thread class I had with Mary Fry, that people walked around and they thought I was actually doing something different. And because my work looked so different, and it was all because I pulled it tighter than anybody else. And so I wasn't being a renegade after all.
Yeah. Yeah. So the needle point is the one through all this. Needle point is remained your base, but you've retained other techniques and then mixed them in.
I've used my background to, first of all, my taste in design. I love to do geometrics, but so many other people are doing them that I don't really specialize as much in those, unless I really get turned on by an idea. But most of what I like to do is flora and fauna, and which goes back to probably my early, my taste is actually there. And that involves leaves and curves and things that are difficult to do on canvas, but right. I can use those crewel techniques to get those smooth outlines, and I just have to convince my students that they can do it too, and it usually works with a little bit of practice. They're just so used to everything being so structured that if you use the word, freely drawn, exactly.
Yeah. So. Well, see, that was. I had always had you in my mental catalog of things, always had you slotted in with all the other people who do geometrics, which is, those are the ones I do the most of because I really enjoy those. And then it was in getting ready for this conversation that it hit me, you don't do that much geometric work. You do.
No,
so,
and my style is totally different too.
Oh, very,
I think I've only used one Jessica in one particular piece where it was, I needed to do ovals. But at the time when I actually was exposed to that kind of what I called, curve stitching, through an English lady that wrote me a thank you note. And she had poked all these holes in a card and laced it with all this beautiful, work that was curve stitching. So I wrote her and asked her how she learned to do that. And she said they did it in school in England. And then she offered me one of her textbooks because she had two copies of it. Oh. So I looked at it and I said, oh, well, maybe I'll do a little mini workshop on this because it looks like fun. And it's not unlike, a couple of the toys my kids had when they were little,
right.
The Spirograph. So about that time, I heard about Gene Hilton on the West Coast doing this similar type work. And I said, nope, if I put something like this out there, they're all going to think I'm copying Gene. So I gave actually that book to Ilsa Althier, who was my black work teacher. And she did an adorable Book of Angels using the same technique on linen. So it got passed on. But I will occasionally fool with it. But if I do, it's going to be a Curdy Biggs, design or someone else, because I don't want to spend my time designing one of those.
Yeah. Well, and borrowing from Gene Hilton, an awful lot of people have cranked out a lot of designs based on that woman's creativity.
She did us all a great service the way many of the other innovative teachers have done and passed it on.
Yep. Oh, yeah, that's... I think we could make the argument she changed the course for so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, she took it a step further. I mean, ironically, I mean, I had a class with Mary Rhodes early on in the 70s because the Connecticut River Valley chapter brought over several of the English ladies. And the Rhodes stitch is one of the parabolic stitches. And the motion is the same. It just happens to make a square or a rectangle, depending on where you place it. But she used to say, if you take this rhythm, you can make it fit any shape you want. And I should have realized at the time that was the same, idea as curve stitching or Spirograph. But it just never occurred to me to play with it in that manner.
Right. The Spirograph. You'd get 3/4 of the way done and the pen would slip. It's like, oh, geez.
Yes. It's like a compass.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Yeah. All that work for nothing. Thanks a lot.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you don't have to. You just let the computer do it
right.
for you.
Yeah, just watch it. Yeah, just watch it on the screen. Yeah. You're. Mm-hmm. So do I get the sense right that it's the stitches that drive your designs? I mean, is that the starting point? How do you go about your designs? What's the mental process?
Okay. Well, I have done several of my own original designs. I mean, I've done a fair number, but I'm most motivated when I find a design that I like. And fortunately, I've been privileged to use other artists' work and adapt them to my own purposes. And the first person that I approached actually was Charlie Harper in the early, I guess I moved to Potomac, Maryland in 1980. And I discovered his Four Seasons poster in the studio of one of my early friends that I made there. And I asked her, I said, does anybody ever stitch from this man's work? Because it was so geometric. And yeah. she said, call Beverly. And when I called her friend Beverly, Beverly said, oh, Charlie's from Cincinnati. And every year at the Cincinnati Nature Center, they have a showing with one of his bird or some of his birds and then the needlepoint interpretations of it. Oh. So I knew at that point that people were actually doing needlepoint versions of his pieces. But what I had to clear was whether or not I'd be able to teach him and do my thing with him. So this was only 1980, so we didn't have email. And being an artist, Charlie didn't like to really write a whole lot, you know, either. So I wrote him a long letter, and I got just a very quick note back saying, go for it. So I had to write him again and said, well, what do I owe you a little more than go for it.
Yeah,
for the privilege of it. And I actually never got into a contract or anything. He just said, please send me a picture. And the first one I did was Raxnack, which was a raccoon snitching from a bird feeder at night. And it had a lot of three-dimensional work on it. And it had black work background above the limb, and it had a darning pattern below the limb. So we went back and forth. He didn't like to use the phone either, you know, and we went back and forth explaining all this in letters. And his wife, Edie, was a quilter, so she understood. And I didn't meet him for probably three more years. Gail Cerna and I drove down to a regional in Cincinnati, and I went over to where he was doing a showing at the Park Center and met him. And he asked if he couldn't come to lunch the next day. So he and Edie came to the actual seminar. And at that time, I had finished Valentine to show him. And he was very much interested and intrigued by the fact that it wasn't just plain needlepoint. Uh-huh. Apparently, all the other previous pieces had been basket weave only.
Yeah.
So I was pleased that he was so pleased. And the only thing he ever asked of me was to borrow two of the pieces for one of his other showings. And it happened to be in Cincinnati. And the two ladies that eventually became KD Artistry were actually doing cross-stitch designs of historical homes in the area. And Charlie had been approached many times about painted canvases, but they were always out-of-town people. And being an artist, every artist needs to be a little bit of a control freak. And he really wanted to be a part of this. And so the first people that he said yes to were the KD Artistry ladies. And they did both needlepoint and cross-stitch designs and were the first ones to really market his work. But what he did not anticipate was that I was going to get a cease and desist order from their lawyers. And so we had to work something out. He was actually quite surprised, but naive about something like that. And so we worked it out that I could go ahead and continue to teach the four designs that I had planned on doing, and but not to do any more. So that was fine. I needed to kind of move on in a new direction anyway. But quite recently, I've gotten involved with another artist who has very similar geometric style. And Eleanor is a graphic artist. So she, with Charlie, I always had to kind of get permission to, you know, can I have to explain to him that when I was doing the free form leaves, that I couldn't fit 28 of them in one canvas, that I could I just do an odd number and scatter them in a similar manner. Yeah. And he understood that. But with Eleanor, I don't even have to ask. It's almost more is better. So, the interesting backgrounds and the borders that I try to put on her pieces, I've never really had to, clear ahead of time. I just do it and then send her a picture, and she's delighted. So, but that's the difference between somebody who's more into pattern per se.
Right.
One of my fondest moments with Charlie was that since I only sent him pictures, when I did the cardinal, which is birdbath, the first thing he did was he did call me that time and he said, "How did you get my bird to fly?" And he had only had radiating lines as wings on the bird. And I had taken a blackwork pattern and used one that was an alternating square and octagon. So when I did it in two layers, I shifted the second layer so that the octagons were over the squares of the first one. And it gave a little flutter to it. Uh-huh. And I was surprised that he would pick up on the flutter, you know, in a photograph like that.
Right.
But he did and wanted to actually know how I had done it. And I didn't really anticipate getting the total impact that I did, but it was worth a try and it worked.
Yeah.
So.
Well, what a fun exchange. That's too bad. The unintended consequences of those kinds of things, and then you weren't able to explore more of his pieces because so many of his pieces have been done so many ways, and
right.
but still you have a more unique, certainly a unique approach to it.
And... Well, I've been asked to do stitch guides, but I just won't do it because most of the painted canvases are on 18 count, and I can't get my effects on 18 with on a very simple design, I could, but on most of the ones that I see today, there's no way you could get the details in my mind that I would like to do. So I've declined when people have asked me if I would do stitch guides.
Because you need the Congress cloth to do it?
Yeah, to get the details.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it's most of what I like to say that my stitch treatments are original, but a lot of my designs are adaptations because I have gotten the permission of the artist to use the line drawing. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, if you have a good line drawing when you start, it's hard to mess it up.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've seen a lot of things not be as well planned all the way through. So I kind of like that restrictive, start that I have. And then I can enlarge and I can make it fit what I'm trying to do, but I don't try to change the actual proportions if I have the privilege of doing another artist's work. I like to stay pretty close to their intentions, but then I dress it up with my interpretation.
Yeah, that whole artist permission thing. I mean, I have no interest in designing, but I did run across a piece of art one time. I thought, I can see a needlepoint design in that. I should, I should draw that out. And then as an editor, my first thought was, all right, first I have to get permission. And it's like, never mind. Just never mind.
Yeah, for your own enjoyment, it works. But
yeah.
I have a couple of Charlie's prints and I'll never stitch them, now because I just enjoy the prints for what they are.
Right.
But when I had a reason to actually... do them as a class. It was a different kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So makes you finish things.
Yeah. A lot of your designs, you use the ground cloth, the canvas to play off the stitches by using open stitches. Does that come obviously from your black work background and interest? How does that design? You use that effectively anyway.
Yeah, the canvas came first. Most people don't realize this today, but we had colored canvas back in the mid-70s. A lady named Eleanor Bockheim was actually, the OOE Congress cloth was imported. And from Denmark, and she was over dyeing it in many different colors at the time. I saw that canvas and I knew that I could get the kind of results that I wanted, not necessarily with counted thread techniques, but when I was in certification, I had to do a sampler of stitches. And I had actually done a whole notebook of samplers of stitches, and I wasn't sure what was important, the form or the content. But I was required to do do it in sampler form rather than notebook form. So in my mind, I didn't want to just repeat the same stitches I'd already done. So I took a piece of red Congress cloth and two different weights of pearl cotton, and I just took a lot of different stitches and made it into a band sampler, using them in an open way. And what I discovered was that the negative space in many cases was prettier than the actual stitched area. So then it began a whole new challenge of, okay, how can I make this negative space more prominent?
Right.
Usually you don't want your background to be that prominent. Sometimes I'll do the actual pattern in brighter colors and then soften it for a background. But backgrounds were probably the earliest use of open patterns. But I found that, I could combine more things, not necessarily using counted thread techniques, but using the layering with couching, too. Some of my patterns have actually 6 or 7 different, different steps. And with that combination of the laid thread first, it became harder to cover the canvas. So I began to use more of the colored canvas just so it would not be the harsh white anymore.
Right.
So it was kind of an integrated thing. I wouldn't say I deliberately chose it, but I choose the Congress cloth because of the delicacy.
Right.
And as a teacher, you don't want your pieces to be huge either. So I could contain them to something that was 14 that would require no less than or no more than a 16 or 18 count stretcher bars.
Right.
Or inch stretcher bars.
Yeah.
So it helped to get the detail that I wanted as well. And the border. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the problems I find with painted canvas is that they don't give you enough extra canvas to add a border. If you want to.
Yeah.
So you really have to start from scratch. And I generally will design my borders first and then blow up the interior part to fit in a graceful way.
Mm-hmm.
But those two areas are the two that I plan first, both the background and the border. And probably the most originality is there in my work.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when I first learned needlepoint, it was just beat into me that you're to cover the canvas that,
yes.
That
was the number one priority.
Yeah.
And judging point as well. If you entered something.
Oh yeah. I was told that. Yeah. If a judge ever mm-hmm. looked and your canvas wasn't covered. Oh, heavens.
Mm-hmm. But how many threads cover fully,
right.
without being tedious? I mean, that's why we only use Persian yarn too.
Yeah. Cause that had enough expansion in it to cover about anything. But yes. that sapped the fun out of it for me, because uh-huh. I would stitch the multicolored design, and then mm-hmm. it was always all right. Now I got to palm my way through the background, basket weaving to the till I dropped, and I just mm-hmm. it just took the fun out of it for me, and so that I try to force myself to do background as I go, but even mm-hmm. that was boring, and if I'd known at the time that their open stitches existed and that I could do that and it would go faster and look as good and in many cases better, it would have changed mm-hmm. things for me dramatically.
Yeah. No, I think the newer stitchers have an advantage in that respect. I think if there's any weakness today, a lot of people do not have the advantage of having a good foundation when they first start. They always start with a project, and a project limits you to what you can learn. And as much as I love, our guilds and our opportunities for workshops, I did have the good fortune of having, by chance, a good teacher in my area, and I studied with her for like 7 years before I moved on and had another, point of view. And we did not do a finished piece for the first 2 years. But by the end of that 7 years, I had had, I mean, we kind of kept her working too, because she had not, she had come to us at that killer tavern that I explained to you. We needed somebody to help us evaluate some lace. I mean, if you have an old house or an old, any kind of historical project, you always get textiles dumped on you. And our curator wanted us to display these beautiful lace things in the garden house that was in the back. And we didn't know what to do. We didn't know how to wash them. We didn't know how to press them. We didn't know how to repair some of them. And this lady walked in who happened to be related to Hope Hanley by a foster relationship. And we sort of made Darlene become a teacher, which was wonderful for all of us. She had just moved to Ridgefield, and she was doing some painted canvas because she was an art major. Uh-huh. But when she was at the University of Maryland, her, I guess, counselor did not really like her style of painting. And she decided if she couldn't dazzle him with her style, she'd baffle him with something he didn't know about. So she actually went to the Smithsonian, number one, and got a conservation degree earlier. But she called her friend Hope Hanley, who was living in Richmond at the time, and said, "Hope, how do I go about learning needlepoint in a hurry?" And Hope said, "Go to the Library of Congress and study with every book that you can get your hands on there." And she did it within you know, the time frame that was required, and then just let all this marinate for several years when she married and moved to Connecticut, where we were. And as we were, you know, taking care of all these pieces of lace and working on the exhibit, we found out that she had this background. And we said, well, we've had this teacher coming to us from Wallingford, Connecticut, who's probably overqualified for the job. Would you like to, you know, take on some of the classes that we were offering? And she did, and we just kind of clung to her. And I think of the eight people that started with her, four of us are certified teachers. The other three have never been traveling teachers like I have, but they've always done their thing locally, either through a shop or in their home. So it was quite an experience, and we were all young and eager to learn. And Darlene even went down to New Jersey to the Silk and Metal group down there because we had heard about it. And she happened to be an Episcopalian, and the idea of doing the sampler that they offered appealed to her. And she also had a husband who worked out of the home. So she was able to take the time to drive down there. So the following year, she made us all design our own pieces, and she found areas in our pieces for silk and metal techniques. And I don't think I could probably do that today. One person had an elephant. I had a cruel design. Someone else had seashells. And for her to be able, after 1 year of exposure to that, to be able to end up having all of us doing our own thing on a different type of design was incredible. Yeah. But that's the kind of person she was. And then she finally, you know, said it's time to, she had to go back to school and wanted to. And so she decided we should all spread our wings and go around to different areas. And that's when we had already started our guild at that point. But two or three of us started driving to Hartford for classes and down to Bronxville for other classes as well, because Westchester chapter was pretty close by too.
Yeah.
So that was when I got more of my exposure beyond needlepoint.
It's interesting how through your career, the design part has just been part of your learning rather than I'm going to sit down and design things.
It just kind of evolves.
Yes. Yeah, because so many people, they learn to stitch, then they have an idea, and then they start designing. But it's just kind of been part of your progression all along. That's interesting.
Well, I think it's kind of personal. You know, if I want to do it, I don't really think of what commodity is going to be popular. If I want to do it, I just do it and hope that there are enough people out there that like it that I'll get to teach it several times. And up till I moved to Michigan, it was never really as much of a problem. But in Michigan, it was difficult to put together a travel job because I had to fly out of Flint or a local small airport.
Yeah.
And that was in the 80s. It was so easy to drive everywhere or if I had a 10-day trip, I had to beg for a day off. I mean, the groups were growing so fast and it was very easy to put together the shared transportation. Mm-hmm. But that is a real, you're fortunate because you live in a city where there are lots of guilds. But the more rural areas that really they're lucky if they're able to have one traveling teacher come once a year, twice a year at the most.
Yeah.
And so it makes me appreciate what I had when I had it.
Yes.
During those Renaissance years.
Yeah, well, that's your culture, again, where in the New England area, you have that history, and along with that, and integral to that is the needlework, and then as mm-hmm. you move further west, you get away from that, and harder to keep that going.
Well, it's younger. I found just my whole background in American history was so oriented toward the East Coast. And
right.
although I love learning about Prairie Style and some of the interesting things, you know, out there, I did find, however, the Great Lakes area is a very good, very strong area for stitching technicians, both in Chicago, Detroit based and, you know, all over. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed those years and the first time I taught out there, I found, eager people and very good with very good backgrounds. So mm-hmm. Each area is different. And I found in California my first time, they had a lot of creativity, but they weren't the technicians that we had, you know, on the East Coast.
Uh-huh.
But they were very uninhibited and terrific designers. A lot of them, you know, did very creative wardrobe and clothing and things that I had never gotten involved in. So each area has its own stamp. And now there's so much mobility with people moving around that it's kind of leveled the playing field. I think we have strong bases everywhere.
Yeah. I was going to say that those clear cultural differences are just kind of melding all together and
mm-hmm.
because of the ability to share.
And, exactly.
Maybe a good, maybe a bad. I don't know if that is.
Yeah, well, I think it's, I know when we first started, we had all the smockers, we had all the quilters all under one roof. And now each group has their own guild. So, but I think we still communicate, you know, well. And one of the things I enjoyed in the Midwest was belonging to a fiber guild, which is primarily weavers, but in our particular group, it was something I could do during the day. And we took great field trips. We had a lot more exposure to color and design from different points of view. And the emphasis wasn't so much on workshops as such. The weavers would get together on their own, but our workshops were more devoted to art and fiber in general. Mm-hmm. Which I found very stimulating at that point in my life. But I've always said that's one reason why I've stuck with needlework, because to me it has three facets. In addition to enjoying the stitching part, I've always found the conservation interesting, and I found the ethnic embroideries fascinating as well. So when I first started taking classes, there were a number of opportunities to learn ethnic embroideries like hardanger, Greek embroidery, Ukrainian embroidery, and those things. So that kind of fed my historical side.
Talk about your publishing. What do we have here? Nine books?
I mean, that was actually Bill's idea initially. When I remarried and moved to Midland, my husband had done a lot of writing for darkroom techniques, and his hobby was photography.
Ah.
So I actually had never done computer graphics until I met Bill either. And most of my friends, I was just getting into some work, on Macs through some friends. But Bill was more PC-oriented. So he said, if you're going to stick with me, we have to do it the PC way. And at that time, there was only two people that I knew who were working with PC, and one of them was Jane Zimmerman out in California. And fortunately, Jane was patient enough with me and that I had my introduction through her. But between her and Bill, I finally got on board and was able to, I found I enjoyed graphics once I overcame the mechanics of it, and eventually got curious enough that I could make the, you know, what if, things happen on a computer as well. But being where we were living with Dow Chemical's headquarters, we also had two major publishing firms in the actual area that I could work with. And I chose Blackwork for my first book just because I found I wanted to make Canvas people like it. Canvas people were resisting double running. And in my mind, for a very good reason. I mean, when you do needlepoint, you want to wrap your stitches. And many times, you know, if you're doing double running, you're going to not enjoy that return trip because you just have that traveling thread in your way and you have to fix it. So right. I found once I had met Jane and several of the people on the West Coast, we're doing what I call a combination of alternating stitches, running stitches followed by black back stitches and combination method. Which works really well until you run into a dead end. But what I had decided to do was a number of things to make it easier for me doing it on canvas, number one, because your thread will shift in the hole a whole lot more and it looks a lot more crooked. So over the years of the lessons that I'd had with several mentors, I was also beginning to branch out and do my own thing with Blackwork. And I found needle pointers were much more receptive to it. But it meant that I had to design my own patterns as well, because most of the historical patterns did not zigzag. And the minute you have a straight line, you get that ugliness and that you know, lack. You have to create the illusion of a straight line.
Right.
So most of my patterns have been created for the situation that I, you know, am using. And consequently, I no longer just do it over two, under two, the way most of the Blackwork patterns have been done in the past. I merge the stitches into four, which is not that long a stitch on Blackwork. Mm-hmm. And it can be much prettier. So as I accumulated this kind of expertise on my own, I thought, well, maybe I have enough here to share. But I knew I had to get the permission of my mentor, Ilse Altier, because you can't teach Blackwork without using her pathfinder, or you can teach basic Blackwork without using her pathfinder theory. But what she gave to us was a method of doing an all-over pattern in a very systematic way. And I had to use her language. And so once I attained her permission, she had actually encouraged me to do it a lot sooner than I thought I was ready. But that became my first book. And I found I always did enjoy writing. Once I moved, my first classes were actually correspondence courses because my family was at an age where I couldn't really be away from home. So I had the opportunity to teach group correspondence courses through the Embroiderers Guild. Mm-hmm. And I found when you learn to write things that completely, you get a chance to edit as well. I found it was much more satisfying. And so when I started teaching too, I put more into my lesson plans than a lot of the former teachers had been doing. And some of this related to copyright issues. I think, you know, one of the common complaints in the 70s was that if you took a class and you tried to go back to that piece a year and a half later when you had more time, there wasn't enough in that lesson booklet that you could pick it up and actually finish the piece without a good working, knowledge of the subject.
Yeah.
So I decided and had learned through the correspondence teaching that I was going to teach this way. And I've never really had anybody abuse me. That I know of, as far as being able to hand out information wholesale. So I think there was enough education about copyright issues within the guild market, at least, that I don't think most people do that anymore.
Yeah.
Although I do understand that on the internet it can be flagrant at times.
Yes. Yeah. But, yeah. There's it's a problem. Yeah, it's a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it will always be a problem with simple things. But I don't worry because I know that nobody can see seven layers in something particular. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No chance of that.
If they do, they go blind trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
So, well, but one of the things I think is missing, though, in a lot of lesson booklets is having complete sequences, because all these stitch encyclopedias that I studied in the 70s only gave you a left to right or right to left sequence, and it didn't teach you how to turn around properly in a pattern so that you would maintain that tension on the stitches. I felt that was important enough that I did want to include it and not just have a start. And when I moved to Michigan, I absolutely had to teach that way because of my pilot students were all over the on the East Coast, and I couldn't take them with me. So I actually pilot through a correspondence course, and then I do have a second pilot class with a group where I have a hands-on as well, so that I know that my lesson plan will fit the amount of time that we have for a particular class. Yeah. But that can vary depending on the size of the group. It can also vary with the experience level. So that's, to me, is less important than having a mistake on a graph. That can create real problems in class, more so.
Oh, those days when everything had to be done by mail. Oh.
Yes.
Oh. Because you talk about,
get used to it.
You talk about that, and you take me back to the early days of being a magazine editor, where everything was a typewriter, and then you'd mail out the manuscript, and oh, geez, had to work months in advance just to get anything done. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. These days, if they're not back to you in half an hour, what's the problem?
Well, that's, I must say, I've thoroughly enjoyed working for Elizabeth at Needlepoint Now. She's on top of everything, and makes it easier for the rest of us.
Sure. Now, you've contributed to that magazine for how long?
Probably nine, going on 10 years.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure when Elizabeth first, I knew Joyce Lukomsky very well, because we went back to early certification days together. But when Elizabeth took over the magazine, I couldn't figure out, I didn't know who she was. And when she called, I asked her, I said, how do you know me? And she said, well, I've been on the A&G selection committee for 5 years.
Oh.
So, but she was never chairman. So you never know who the other ones are.
Oh, okay.
But
she knew
other
you.
Than that, well, she knew of me, certainly. But I never had her as a student. So somehow she trusted me, and it's worked out well together.
That's great. Okay, and this happens every time. Now we're out of time, but if I'm going to buy one of your books, which one am I buying?
I really can't tell you. I mean, you mentioned that you like the open work. So one of the books, it doesn't say it's open work, but Potpourri of Pattern and Potpourri of Pattern Encore do emphasize open patterns much more so than the other books, because in my mind there's open and there's slightly open. When I have open holes, that's a lot of my backgrounds have open holes because they're more exposed. But I have a lot of slightly open patterns that have open threads but no open holes. So when you design the sequences for the open patterns, that to me is the thing you have to learn. How to conceal the traveling thread, and both of those books have some information on what I call simulated darning, because darning is becoming the way on painted canvases that people are using open patterns the easy way. But I still see that cluttered hole behind there, as well as the paint. And I figured out several ways in some backgrounds to have it look like darning, because it's all parallel satin stitches. But you have a tracking sequence that will conceal the traveling thread. And then you have that dark background in some negative space that makes the pattern much, much more prominent.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my suggestion. Some of the other books are more specialized, like the canvas applique was actually geared toward people people who are doing the Master Craftsman program or who just plain like to put three-dimensional effects in their pieces.
Yeah.
But those two were written probably 10 years apart as well. So my growth is reflected more so in the Potpourri of Pattern Encore. And I also included some other that's a full color book, and it's includes other people's work as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that interests me because that's one of my little things that I want to get better at is if you have to travel that thread, how do you make sure it doesn't show? And you know, what is the stitch path? What do you do to not have it appear behind a hole and just visually for me ruin it? So
yeah. Well, the main word is pivot. And you just have to know when and how to pivot.
Okay.
Because when you pivot, that changes the direction of the traveling thread. And sometimes it's just plain I often, you know, the other word that people dread is compensation all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to say, you know, compensation is not a problem if you choose an intelligent stitch. So to me, avoiding the awkward compensation is the key thing, and not setting yourself up for a nightmare, you know, by choosing the wrong stitch.
Yeah. And really glad we had a chance to talk. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to hearing more of your podcasts now that I've heard a couple of them.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for the time. And folks need to go. It's AnnStrikeKurtz.com, and her designs are there and the books and the whole bit. So go check those out. And thanks to everybody for listening.